From an accounting standpoint, one consequence of the coronavirus pandemic is disruption in the preparation and auditing of financial statements. With unparalleled upheaval, the event triggers questions for financial statement preparers and practitioners around asset impairment, auditors' reports, and more. This is Neil Amato with the Journal of Accountancy. On today's podcast, CPAs Danielle Subkus-Cheek and Christy Aluzzi share guidance on multiple fronts for preparers and practitioners. Danielle is a director at PKF Texas in Houston and chair of the AICPA Private Companies Practice Section Technical Issues Committee, known as TIC. Christy is the AICPA's staff liaison to TIC. Here's our conversation, recorded Monday, March 30th. Joined on the podcast by Danielle Subkus-Cheek and Christy Aluzzi. Christy and Danielle, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
I guess I'll start with Danielle first. What are your general thoughts on how preparers and practitioners should be approaching their work at a time when the coronavirus pandemic is obviously causing tremendous disruption in public health, the business environment, and people's personal lives?
I think the first thing to think of is that you're not going through this alone, and the issues that you're experiencing, others are experiencing, and that the issue you may be seeing for your client or for your own company, there are others. So there's other resources out there for you. You don't have to figure this out on your own. There are resources from the AICPA and other thought leaders. As well as just because the way you did something in the past was the way your firm's methodology was, or the way you process something in the past, doesn't mean that has to be the way of the future. And to get creative about how to think about solving problems. My background is typically in some kind of oddball accounting situations, and I've been getting a lot of phone calls on very traditionalist mindset of, we used to do it this way, there's no way we can ever do it again that way. And I've tried to give lots of creative ideas on ways that you can still accomplish the same end goal with the limitations we have in place today. So just get creative and reach out.
Thank you. Christy, obviously there's a lot to figure out, but how do you start to figure out whether the consequences of the pandemic represent subsequent events under FASB ASC 855? And what do you do if you determine the subsequent events guidance applies?
So that is the million-dollar question right now, right? And probably the one that we are getting the most questions on through the AICPA, through our hotline, the Center for Plain English Accounting, and other channels. That is probably the most frequently asked question. As some overarching guidance, you know, I would say that when you look at subsequent events, there are two types, right? There are type one and type two. For entities with a December 31st year end, I would say it's probably a little bit easier in that these events were not known as of December 31st. So you would have a type two subsequent event, which would normally result in disclosures only. We're going to go into later in this podcast what some of those disclosures might relate to, you know, on risks and uncertainties, of course, would be one of them. Declines in market value subsequent to year end might be another. But that's really the big question that we have been getting. Now, the tricky part is we are now getting into the end of March, early April, and you have entities that now, if they have year ends that are falling soon, we are now in this pandemic, right? And Danielle, you might be able to touch on this a little bit as well. But, you know, I've seen some diversity in when this became type one, if you will, because there's really no, you know, FASB didn't expect something like this to happen, nor did they address that in the guidance. So you have to use some judgment there. Some are saying that somewhere around February, when this became a little bit more well-known, you might be tripping into type one. Others use more the date we declared the national emergency in March is probably when you're steeping into, you know, those type one subsequent events. So I think for entities that have year ends that are now after December 31st, it's going to be a little bit harder to determine whether you're in that type one or type two situation. You know, the AICPA is putting out a lot of guidance for those of you that are sort of watching the Journal of Accountancy and other alerts and reports that have come out of AICPA, we do address some of this. We do have some sample disclosures that have come out of public companies, but you have to remember a lot of those are December 31st, you know, year end. So we have yet to see too much from public companies on that. But Danielle, I just wanted to maybe get your perspective on that as well and what you're hearing from your clients.
Yeah. And I'd say it depends on the type of business that somebody is in and how it impacts them. If you have a domestic only company, that's going to be a much different date of when it was really impactful in the United States versus somebody that has Chinese operations or even their domestic company with supply side risk in China because of Chinese manufacturing or other distribution into the United States. So I think it also depends on the company and their operations of when was it impactful to you on where that kind of line is going to fall. What's going to be kind of convenient, I guess, for the lack of a better word, is that most companies don't have a January 31st or February 28th year end. So the likelihood that you have a client or you are a company that falls within these really hard judgment calls of end of January versus end of February are going to be fairly minimal compared to most are going to be December 31st. And then there's going to be a March 31st is a common one, but not nearly as common as December 31st. But I really think spending that extra time to assess how is your company impacted by this and when did you start seeing the impacts is going to help frame are you type one or type two if you fall somewhere between December 31st and March 31st.
There's a chance that in some cases, management's judgment related to certain accounting estimates may no longer be reasonable as a result of the pandemic. How can practitioners evaluate this? I guess Danielle first.
Sure. This really ties into the conversation we just had about subsequent events. And no estimate's ever going to be perfect. But if something's a type one versus a type two subsequent event, it also changes how you integrate with other parts of the standards. So if you have a type two subsequent event and your estimates were correct as of the end of the year or reasonable, that's a much different scenario than a type one subsequent event. And so I think you're just going to have to use judgment as either the preparer of those estimates or as management, the auditor instead of management, and spend some time with, does this make sense? Is it reasonable? And don't forget that if you have a type two subsequent event, you're still going to have those risk disclosures and you still have footnotes related to management's use of estimates related to that there could be differences in the estimates. So while I know everybody in the accounting world likes to have a certain amount of precision, let's take a step back and think about what's reasonable given the circumstances. And are we getting at a threshold that it's probably reasonable?
What about asset impairment considerations? What do preparers and practitioners need to keep in mind related to that? And then also, I guess, what happens when an impairment occurs or liability is incurred after the date of the financial statements, but before the statements are issued?
Yeah, so I think this one, again, similar to subsequent events, is probably a lot easier for entities with a December 31 year end, because for the most part, their assets, you know, all of that should be left intact as of the balance sheet date, because this is, in essence, a type two subsequent event. For entities that, and as Danielle said earlier, if you're a March 31st year end, this is where asset impairment could become a real issue. You would have to potentially engage specialists to assist you with that. And I know that, Danielle, you can probably get into that in a minute, because I know that you do some of that work for your clients. But to me, one of the things that's come up, the questions about private companies through our private company practice section, you know, now private companies have the alternative to amortize goodwill. And if they had taken up that alternative, let's say 5 years ago when it became available, they may not have as much worry, if you will, because they've already been amortizing those assets over the past 5 years. So the goodwill impairment test might not be that complex. I will say where it might be complex is if you had an entity that did a recent acquisition, maybe they either did not elect the PCC alternative or they've only been amortizing for a short period of time. That's where they may need to engage a specialist, especially if you are in one of those businesses that's severely impacted. You know, I'll give airlines, hotels, restaurants might be, you know, some examples of that. But there is also an option to private companies that I'm not sure everyone has thought about. And Danielle, I'd love to get your thoughts on this one. But for private companies, you could also take a gap exception on goodwill. If it is going to be that cumbersome and result in a lot of costly, you know, for an entity when they're already strapped for cash and their cash flows are looking pretty bleak, you know, for them to engage a specialist to look at their goodwill in all cases is not going to be prudent. And certainly as long as they're users of the financial statements, and in most cases that would be banks for smaller private companies, if they're okay with that gap exception, that would be another option for private companies to sort of save some money, if you will, in the system. Danielle, I'd love to get your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach, actually. You know, you don't usually like to be, pushing gap departures and being proponent of gap departures, but it's a good idea because it's going to remedy itself at some point. So usually when you have a major event like this and you have a downward impairment, there's no recapture in US GAAP. But if you're amortizing goodwill and each year you're taking that 1/10 off, assuming you've elected the default period, you're going to eventually get to the point where that goodwill comes off the books in full on the amortization schedule. So it's a GAAP departure that would remedy itself rather than stay on for a long time. The other thought is too, is if your goodwill really is for an acquisition that is of something that doesn't exist anymore or is about to go completely out of business due to the severity of some of these situations, there may not be any goodwill anymore. And so, you know, your going concern analysis may start playing into your goodwill impairment analysis. And I know we're going to talk about going concern in a little bit. And while I don't like to be a proponent of not having to do the math, but if it's really quite obvious that this is no longer effectively going concern, there's not going to be goodwill associated with whatever that transaction was. And so you could just get to the point where you no longer have goodwill, which would be an impairment of the full amount, which understandably is not an ideal situation. So if it's not something that's black or white on either there's no impairment or full impairment, a gap departure would be a reasonable approach to move forward, knowing that your bank would have to be okay with that gap departure, or whoever is your user, of course.
You mentioned going concern. Going concern judgments, unfortunately, are coming into play as a result of the pandemic. How should CPAs be thinking about going concern in this current environment?
Well, so I guess my take on this would be that I can't really think of a company that wouldn't at least consider going concern or think about it in this environment, to be quite honest. So I think you're going to see that, and this is a strange circumstance we are seeing here, you'll probably see more going concern disclosures than ever in US history, if I had to guess, or at least management's consideration of going concern and performing that evaluation, you know. And now, as of, I guess it was a few years ago, that guidance is also required for management. It is not just something that the auditor is required to do, but there would be a reminder there to speak to management and make sure that they've sort of gone through and done the assessment of going concern. But I would also say, you know, it's like Danielle said earlier, everyone's going through this, right? This is not a perfect science. Going through this going concern exercise is not going to be, we can't give you a specific, you know, playbook for doing this. I would say have that communication with management. Make sure they are aware of what they need to be thinking about. Make sure they've performed some analysis, especially in cases where you are talking about industries and areas of the economy that are being really significantly impacted. Evaluate that with management. And, you know, again, I think there's this fear out there about putting those disclosures in, right? That's going to look really bad. It's going to hurt your funding. It's
self-fulfilling prophecy is the concern me.
So I would just say, you know, if it does meet the criteria, the FASB criteria, if you're following, you know, FASB GAAP, you do have to disclose when there are certain triggering, you know, when you meet that criteria. But don't be too scared. And I would say on the audit side, Danielle, we've been hearing that auditors are kind of afraid to look at it. They're afraid maybe management hasn't done enough or that some of those assumptions might not be 100% accurate. I think we have to be okay with a little bit of leeway here, leaving a little bit of of judgment to be used here, because it really is a new world right now we're dealing with when it comes to going concern. So I would tell auditors, don't be afraid. You know, if management's willing to work with you on this, even though you can't get within a certain level of precision, there might be a little bit of, you know, you have to live a little bit with the unknown in this space of going concern. And I think we're going to see more going concern disclosures than ever before. What's your take, Danielle?
I completely agree. I think that most companies in the past have been so fearful of the going concern, anything related to going concern or lack of liquidity in their footnotes, because it was could hurt them in some other way to their users. Right now, that's not the threat to the organization. The threat is this pandemic. And so the going concern footnote is no longer the threat to the survival of a company that is maybe potentially on the margin. And so because of that, it's not going to, the user of the financial statement is not going to change how they rely upon the financial statements with the amount of precision that may or may not be in that management assessment. I think everybody's going to be expecting to see something about COVID in financial statements and the risks and uncertainties. And it's really going to depend on what day you're releasing financial statements, on what information is known to the available at the time of issuance, on how that's going to change. And even if you got this out the day before something was released, people are going to have the right context and understanding of what's happening in the world and the marketplace to understand how your financials fit into it. And so the reliance on the user of the going concern disclosure on the level of precision. Clearly, if you need to have it, you need to have it. But the amount of effort and worry spent on precision, I think, is going to be just a lot of effort in futility. And rather, you should spend that effort in some other player areas that may be more of assistance to your client or in other higher risk audit areas. Usually going concern is an extremely high risk audit area that you want to get that right, because management really doesn't want to have a footnote disclosure if they don't need it. In this case, it's a whole different world on this concept. And the existence of that disclosure is not what creates the risk to the company like it probably was in the past. So I completely agree with Christy.
And how does the Tax Act, speaking specifically the CARES Act that was approved, turned into law March 27th, how does that affect disclosures in financial statements?
I think it's going to impact maybe some going concern as well. So the Paycheck Protection Program is going to be a game changer. So that may impact people's assessments of going concern if they're able to qualify for that program. I also think there's going to be a fair amount that we still don't quite all know about tax provisions and calculations of tax provisions under ASC 740. For example, the Paycheck Protection Program, when you get the loan forgiveness, is actually considered non-taxable income. Like, they're not going to tax you on the loan forgiveness. Typically, that is a taxable line item. And for GAAP purposes, you're going to have to show that somewhere as income or gain or something on the income statement to get it off the books. Otherwise, the debt would stay there. And so that's going to create a permanent difference. So there's just going to be lots of nuances as you get into the CARES Act. And how does that impact the risk uncertainty disclosures, the going concern disclosures, and potentially tax provisions as well. So it's still, I think a lot of firms are still just parsing it out. I spent the entire weekend, the weekend it came out, reading it and trying to get up to speed for my clients. I also think there's going to be a lot of opportunity where CPAs can help their clients understand what is the immediate assistance that they can get to help weather this storm.
Yeah, Danielle, and I was reading through sections this weekend, and I was thinking in particular about how this will affect healthcare entities and not-for-profit entities. Higher education is a big one, where now there's certain programs for forgiveness of loans, and how are higher ed institutions going to track all of this, and who's going to audit it? And so, but that's not today, right? That's not for entities that are closing their books now. This is talking kind of like forward looking. I think there's also going to be some pretty big financial impact in 2020 for those companies that are receiving this aid or forgiveness, recording it, how, you know, what the controls are over that, etc.
And as a note for listeners, as things are moving quickly, we are recording this podcast the afternoon of Monday, March 30th. So clearly some things have happened, but plenty can change. So Do you expect to see more emphasis of matter or other matter paragraphs in auditors' reports in the near future? And what are best practices surrounding these? I guess Christy first.
Sure. So just to point out sort of the difference as a refresher for people between emphasis of matter and other matter paragraphs, you know, you really, the auditor is not permitted to emphasize anything or use an EOM paragraph unless it's something that's already in those financial statements. So if you think about those type two subsequent events we were talking about earlier, you may see auditors emphasizing those risks and uncertainties, the going concern, et cetera, in their reports. Now, we've been looking through 10-Ks, and again, most of those are from December 31st. So there definitely was not a ton of consistency in whether or not firms are noting these as emphasis of matter paragraphs. I think as the first quarter filings come through, we'll start to see a lot more EOM paragraphs. When it comes to other matters, I would caution, you know, I come from a private company perspective, not a public one. So I just am going to preface it with that. But For private companies, I wouldn't think that other matter paragraphs would be necessary. And I honestly, from a risk standpoint, would probably stay away from putting other matter paragraphs in reports. Certainly, you could emphasize matters like going concern, risks and uncertainties that are already, management's already put into those disclosures. But if you start getting into other matters, I just think that gets really sticky and starts to look a little bit like CAMS or other, you know, things that really private companies are not required to do. Danielle, I'm curious if you, what your thoughts are on that, dealing a lot with private companies.
We're of the same opinion. And honestly, I also have the same qualifier of I typically deal with private companies. I don't work as much in the public company space. So we typically take approach of we get the bare minimum correct and we get everything that needs to be in. But we don't want to elaborate and create additional complexities or additional work because we're all pretty stretched thin right now. And we're not seeing the additional benefit from it right now. If a client were to specifically request it, of course, that would be a different story. But right now, we don't have clients requesting it. They're stretched to the limit as well and wanting to get things out the door as quickly as possible from a practical standpoint.
Do you foresee potential scope limitations for audits of companies with year ends happening in 2020?
So that's actually something, Neil, we will be issuing the AICPA this week, a report that actually walks through that. It's about 10, 11 pages that walks through some considerations where you could have scope limitations. I will say, in some cases, you may think you have a scope limitation, but there's probably a way to think outside the box, maybe in ways we've never done before, for getting things done. One of the common examples is that we're starting to get asked about with March 31st year ends is inventory observations. You know, there are companies that have essentially shut down or really scaled back their operations, and those inventory observations due to travel limitations right now, the auditors may not be able to observe that inventory in person like they have in the past. And we give a few, you know, ideas. Some of them might be using technology, you know, being able to use cameras, live feeds, going in and basically having the client, if the client, this is assuming the client is at least there, you know, performing those counts and able to be there, but the auditor is not able to be on site. You can certainly use technology. You can ask them to open boxes in front of you. You can have live mics where you're talking to each other and asking them to go to certain sections to check on obsolescence. You know, you can then get the live feeds from that, you know, even as part of your audit documentation. So I think in some cases, you have to kind of think outside the box. You know, we got asked on a webcast we did last week about management representations and how in this environment, the clients all might be working from home and not able to put it on their letterhead. Like physically, they just don't have it, you know, at home with them. And certainly there is no requirement in the standards to have it on letterhead. I think as a best practice, that's what a lot of, you know, companies do. But if you can get something emailed from them that has the company name and address up top, even e-signatures, I mean, there are in some cases some ways to really do it in a different way. You know, access to clients, books and records and internal control. You may have to get a little bit creative on how you do some of that testing, and it's probably not going to be in-person discussions and walkthroughs like you've done in the past. But if you do have access to the client, You can do Zoom calls. You know, we recommend that with like fraud conversations, you do probably want video as opposed to only, you know, audio calls so that you can read body language and really try to see, you know, how they're reacting to the questions that you're asking. But I think, you know, that in many cases, you might think it's a scope limitation to start, but then if you think through a more creative way, especially using the technology we have today, there might be a way to really get there and be able to obtain that reasonable assurance in a way that maybe you didn't before, but still allows you to go ahead and perform your audit. And I'm not going to get too into the weeds because I think the report we have coming out this week really does a good job of outlining what some of those issues might be. But I would say again, this is a whole new world. Don't be afraid to try something a different way. You know, work with your clients, figure out whether they have Zoom technology, make sure everybody has webcams and access to video so you can have those conversations. You know, there might be use the cloud to send things back and forth and secure, you know, means if they need to send you, you know, files to review and to audit. Danielle, I know this is an area, Danielle's very good about thinking outside the box. And as a practitioner, you know, is always coming up with technological, you know, ways to sort of work around issues. So I'd love for her to weigh in on this one as well. But I would just close it with don't be afraid. It may not be a scope limitation if you can work with your clients.
Yes. So yes, this is what I do on a regular basis. And I think, you know, Christy and I have had some long late night chats about different ideas for different people. And start leveraging technology from other industries as well, I think is really important. You know, there are in the real estate space for walking through facilities so that if you want to virtually look like you're at a facility, they make these special cameras that you can actually take a still film of everything and it places it into a platform that you can actually walk through the facility. So if it's a retail storefront that you're needing to inventory and you're allowed to have a camera, it's like one camera person and you can outsource. It's like a service that you can get and somebody that opens the facility and you want to check for, okay, we can't count until 3 weeks from now when things open, hopefully. And we want to just verify that everything looks the same as before, but we can right now, one or two people are allowed with appropriate social distance. Maybe look at something like that. And then you have that walkthrough, or if it's inventory that you can count physically from the video or the pictures, you can do that kind of stuff. You know, drone operators, if you can find drone operators near a facility, you can actually fly drones indoors and outdoors. And if you need to at least inspect something, you might be able to get a drone operator that's nearby the facility that you need to get to. If you have remote capabilities to open a warehouse door remotely, you might be able to start getting creative on using that technology. It's never was intended to be used that way when you were doing your audits in the past, but you might be able to use it. And get creative. I also think that there's a lot of room to be understanding the situation. And if the facility has been locked down and nobody's coming in or out for an inventory observation, then, you know, in the past, there's been some kind of rules of thumb about how long you're supposed to roll back and roll forward is appropriate. But if it's not being touched, that's not really a real thing anymore. It's effectively, you just verify that nobody's had inventory walk away while the facility really has been closed. So there's a lot you can do that is not necessarily what you would normally have done. But I think if you get creative, you can probably get out of most scope limitations. You can also, you know, we don't recommend holding open financial statements for the sake of holding open financial statements, especially with respect to going concern. But for a scope limitation, if you can get a deadline moved and talk to a banker about something because it's related to access of the records and you can't access certain records that are physically on site or something like that in time for a deadline, you can talk to whoever's the user of those financial statements that have set that deadline, assuming it's a deadline that can be moved, and discuss it with them. I've also been in situations where we had, actually had one where I had four different scope limitations on before. And then as each scope limitation was able to be remedied because data would become available and there was a strict deadline, we would reissue the financial statements, removing that scope limitation. It was a very costly approach to doing the financial statements, but we were able to meet the deadline and show a plan to remove each scope limitation based on the ways that the records were being repatriated back to the operation. So get creative and think about alternative ways, not just the way you've always done it.
So that's really helpful advice. In closing, anything else for either of you to add?
Well, I just wanted to remind everybody that the AICPA is here to help in any way that we can. We actually have an entire COVID-19 task force on the ANA side that is dedicated to trying to put out whatever we can to assist our members with the financial reporting, accounting implications, audit, potential SOC work that might be developed as part of this, you know, et cetera. So I would stay tuned in to the AICPA. We will be issuing a lot more alerts and reports for our members. We actually have a COVID-19 resource page on the AICPA, you know, website, and we're putting out webcasts, podcasts, you know, so stay tuned. You know, there's also a lot out there from, you know, the Big Four putting out a lot of papers and stances on this stuff. So we're here to help, you know, and there's going to be a lot of resources that are going to be coming out for you. If you have questions, you also have access to the AICPA's technical hotline, and that is available to all of our members where you can call and ask questions. And we are compiling those questions and trying to put out answers to those questions as soon as we can to our membership. So just as a reminder, we're here to help you guys in any way we can. That's why you have your membership here.
Great. Thank you very much.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.